Hello. In this audio snippet, we intend to continue talking about the 15th Amendment and then talk a little bit about Ulysses Grant's presidency. But before we get to that, we do want to talk about something that seems completely unrelated, but as the more I thought about it, there seemed to be some sort of strange connection to the things we want to get to related to Ulysses S. Grant. So we'll talk about this, hopefully not for too long, and then continue talking about the 15th Amendment and Grant. And the thing we'd like to mention at the beginning here is a story that happened this week. I don't know if it happened yesterday or the day before, but it was sometime this week that the story came out that the whore's Pelosi's house was broken into in the San Francisco area. As you may know, at the time of this recording, the so-called Speaker of the House, that position created by the founding father so brilliantly, and as we've described before, that's one of the many mistakes in the whole system. The current Speaker of the House, and I say that in big quotes, is a whore named Nancy Pelosi, a worthless Democrat, almost you could say demon possessed. And if you don't believe it, just look at her eyes. There's something wrong with her, something really very wrong with her. And the weird thing is that she's old, but with all the other people who've been dying young, especially because of the mRNA gene therapy injections, it's kind of interesting that this thing is not dying off. In part, I guess, because I'm not sure if she really took the actual injection or just some fake solution. So who knows if she has those spike proteins running through her system. But regardless, I mean, she should be dead, but it's like she's artificially kept alive somehow. And it's just pure evil, walking evil. And this worthless woman, who is apparently the daughter of a former mayor of Baltimore, to the shame of Baltimore, she's a member of the House of Representatives, like everybody else, elected from a district in the San Francisco area. And her husband lives there. And her husband had been in the news earlier because of a DUI incident. He was driving under the influence of alcohol, and something happened. He got arrested, and it was a big incident. But apparently, not big enough for the regular media to cover properly. If it had been someone related to Trump, it would have been blown out of proportion. But because it was the husband of this Democrat whore, it was more or less covered up and not made much a deal of. And this fellow called Paul, and it's kind of disgusting that he has such a name, because I always associate the name Paul with good things. But this this Paul Pelosi is also he also seems to be related to shady dealings in terms of stock trading. It's because he seems to make the right purchase before a certain bill gets passed in Congress. So he seems to be ahead of the game a little bit when it comes to stock trading. And people have brought this up, but you know, it's never been investigated. The current government is investigating grandmothers who were within 100 kilometers of Washington D.C. on January 6th, but they don't investigate things like this, which should be red flags that, you know, this is corruption at a high level. So there's this. So this worthless drunk and stock inside trader was at his house, and the whore Pelosi was not there. She was who knows where, maybe in Washington or who knows where that whore is, or was at that time. And this intruder broke in. That's at least the story, that it was an intruder who broke in, and the story is still developing, but some say that he went in and started shouting, "Where is Nancy? Where is Nancy?" And proceeded to attack Nancy's husband, this Paul Pelosi. And it seems like the attack was with a hammer, and the guy hit Paul Pelosi in the head with a hammer, and the guy ended up in hospital and had to have surgery on his brain. So that's more or less the story. And they say that when the police got there, that's another part, this all might be changing later on, but some say that that when the police got there, these two were fighting, and Paul Pelosi had the hammer in his hand, which might mean that, I don't know if that means that he was struggling with the other guy and had control of the hammer when the police showed up. And I don't know who called the police, how they showed up. But the thing is that, the intruder eventually was able to overpower Pelosi and hammer his head. And then he was arrested by police. So I don't know why the police didn't stop it, or if they got there just at the very beginning and were too late in being able to intervene before this worthless bastard got hit in the head. But and all of that, this is just justice. And if you know me, you know what I'm talking about. This is justice for the things that this woman has had coming to her, and it's being manifested first in her husband, then it will be manifested in her, she'll be burning in hell and all that. But so this is just the things that are coming, that like a cloud that has been following her, and it's starting to manifest itself. She cannot last for long under this state of demonic possession, doing all this evil, lying and evil, without consequences in this life and later on. But the thing is that immediately after that happened, the senile bastard who drags his worthless feet, shuffles them around the White House, went out with a statement blaming Republicans for promoting violence and this. And I even saw a tweet or something somewhere that some idiot posted, some Democrat idiot saying, complaining about this environment of intolerance where Republicans violently attack anyone who disagrees with them. And when I read that, it's like, oh my goodness, this is just what they call in psychology projection. Projection at its highest level, you know, them projecting on others what they do themselves. It's just almost as a way to distance themselves from what they do. This is that wording was so creepy, because that's what I say constantly about them. It's as if they were hearing these audio snippets and then saying them in reverse, like, no, that's not us, that's you. It's as if they look in the mirror, and in their heads, the person they see in the mirror becomes their enemy. It's their enemy instead of their own reflection. And that's why they have this very, there's something very wrong with liberals. I mean, if you just analyze them from a psychological or spiritual or whatever perspective, in a very objective way, if you take away all the factors, political factors and all the other considerations, just analyze them as people, without, as I said, considering whether this is right, this is wrong, just look at their behavior in an objective way. If you were like a Martian coming to planet Earth and observing these weird creatures called liberals, especially white liberals, you would see very strange behavior. To them, the riots that can't happen after the George Floyd, the death of this lifelong petty criminal, black criminal, who had a problem with fentanyl and all that stuff, and he died, and then there were these riots, and they cost, I think, around $2 billion worth of damage, you know, businesses set on fire. There were like 17, I think, if I'm not mistaken, people killed in these riots across the country because of the death of this man who was not a civil rights leader protesting in Alabama for freedom for black people. It was just this petty criminal who was selling, I think, cigarettes or something. He was doing some sort of illegal activity, and he was addicted to fentanyl. And there was fentanyl in his system that contributed to his bad health and dying in the midst of the arrest. And so we're not talking about a brave man. And he did a lot of other things. He was a lifelong criminal. And this guy died, and then that was the excuse for black people to go burn stuff and loot and all, do all that. And Democrats look at that, and they see peaceful protest. That's how they describe it. You see the looting, the businesses on fire, people getting killed and violently attacked, you know, not only killed, but others were seriously attacked during these riots. And nothing. To them, it's peaceful protest. And it is also justifiable. It's like, yes, these people have been oppressed for so long, and they need to vent their anger. And it's the white man's fault for putting them in that state of bitterness. But then something like this happens, and suddenly this is violence and evil. The other thing, the riots are not. Or for example, when there was a senator, there's a senator right now called Rand Paul. Interesting, the name is Paul. And I know that's not a coincidence. There's this guy called Paul Pelosi. And there's this Republican senator called Rand Paul from Kentucky. He was viciously attacked by his neighbor in Kentucky. You know, there was some sort of crazy nutjob liberal neighbor next to him who hated his guts because Rand Paul is very outspoken. I don't agree with everything he says, but I do kind of commend him on his moments of bravery when he does say some things and confronts the Democrat system and so forth. And so, and liberals don't tolerate anyone who disagrees with them. You know, just like the tweet said, the Democrat complaining about Republicans not tolerating those who disagree with them, it's actually them, the Democrats, who don't tolerate anyone who doesn't agree with them. So they hate anyone who dares to confront them. So they hate Rand Paul, they hate Trump, they hate anybody who dares to say something that opposes their ideology. How dare you? So the thing is that this neighbor was so hateful and resentful of Rand Paul for being Rand Paul that he attacked him. I don't know the details of how the attack happened, but the neighbor attacked Rand Paul and beat him severely. I don't know if there was a gun involved. I'm not sure, but it was very severe, to the point that Rand Paul had to have an operation to have part of his lung removed, because apparently the guy broke 6 ribs in Rand Paul, and that damaged his lungs, or one of his lungs, and they had to take part of that lung out in surgery. That's how vicious the attack was on a sitting senator. I believe he's a senator, not a member of the House of Representatives, and I apologize if I don't have that right, but he is a sitting member of Congress, and he was attacked viciously. And there was no outrage. There was no big hoopla in the media. Why? Because he's a Republican, and he's an outspoken Republican. He's not even a rhino. You know, you might even want to say something nice in favor of a rhino. But this guy's not even a rhino, a Republican name only. He's a conservative. And because of that, his life is worthless. Who cares? It's like, oh, awesome that he got hit and he almost got killed. He had it coming because he's destroying all this hatred with all this hateful speech. So you see the irony. The Democrat can see what happened to Rand Paul and justify it. And make excuses all day long for it. And then they look at the violence that happened to this guy, Paul Pelosi, who's not even a sitting member of Congress. He's just married to one. And then it's like, oh, this is the greatest evil in the history of mankind. Or you see what happened with, I don't know the details of this either, but there's this Supreme Court justice, whom I loathe, by the way, Brett Kavanaugh, who was appointed idiotically by the idiot Trump, who, listening to the voices of Jared Kushner and all these other idiots that he surrounds himself with, he appointed Brett Kavanaugh for the Supreme Court, and Brett Kavanaugh got elected or voted or allowed into the Supreme Court by the Senate eventually, after a lot of hoopla and attacks on him. They hated him because he was appointed by Trump, so anything that Trump does is evil. This is how Democrats think. They don't think as human beings. They are animals. They're just animals, very vicious animals, hateful, vicious animals. So they were against Kavanaugh, not because of the reasons I would have for not liking him, but because he was just chosen by Trump. And Trump is the enemy, so you just attack anything he does. So the thing is that this Brett Kavanaugh apparently had someone who threatened him with a gun, a gunman, you know, trying to kill him. And there were people on the Democrat side who when asked, do you agree, or what do you think about this that happened, that a sitting Supreme Court justice was almost killed by someone, and do you condemn that? And Democrats would not. I don't remember the name right now, but there's at least one person out there, a Democrat, a known Democrat, who was asked point blank, what do you think about this? And she would not condemn the gunman trying to kill a sitting member of the Supreme Court. So that's what I'm trying to say. Liberals are this very weird creature that looks at one event, and because it has people they like involved, then suddenly it's more than okay. Like, and then they see this exact same event happening, but it's with someone that they do like, and suddenly their reaction is completely different. So we're not talking about rational human beings who analyze things and think things through. It is just evil, just outright evil, and they say and do whatever it takes to achieve their end. Like, I'm digressing a little bit. But there's this other story that I read recently about this black man in Virginia who opened up a Starbucks type, you know, coffee place. It was not Starbucks yet. It was a coffee place of his own, but you know, in that style. And he was run out of business. And you know why he was run out of business? Now, he had, and I saw pictures of his business, and, you know, very nice, you know, very ornate, very, very, very nice place that he had. But he began to suffer from intense stress, emotional and physical stress. He was having a heart condition, And I don't know enough about him to know whether that also is connected to the injections. I don't know if he was one of those who said, yes, let's take the injection. And the stress then combined with the injections gave him heart problems. But the thing is, regardless, he has heart issues because of the stress he's been through. And why has he been stressed? Because I don't know how or why, but he... people in the area found out that he was pro-life, in other words, anti-abortion. And because of that, they started attacking him online, putting in this... I saw some of the reviews of his business, vicious reviews, where they were saying that there were cockroaches outside the entrance that were playing cards and like... ridiculous things, and that the place was full of roaches, and that he and that they saw that that the owner is vicious and evil. That they saw him spit on the coffee before serving it to them, and things like that. And I read some of the things, and I go, well, no wonder. I mean, who that these people and all these people doing these reviews to destroy his business, and he kept, you know, online trying to say, no, this is not true. This is not true. This is all lies. And it got to the point where he said, I can't do this anymore. And he closed the store, his coffee place, a black man. Interesting. A black man. This is all about, these audio snippets are about black America. So at least in that sense, I hope you see the connection that I'm not just saying these things randomly. This black man who was anti-abortion, he somehow voiced that opinion at some point, and because of that, he's being attacked. His business is being smeared, and he was run out of business. And these people are happy that they did it, and they're happy that they did it to a black man because suddenly he's not a black man anymore. See, when they if it's a black man burning down a building. Because some fentanyl addicted, lifelong petty criminal died during an arrest, that's okay. Then it's a black man. Then it's important that the guy is black because that validates his behavior, that justifies it. But if it's a black man saying, don't kill a fetus. See, both are saying in a very weird way, black lives matter. That's what the rioting guy killing people and burning down buildings and businesses is saying. Oh, the life of George Floyd matters. Doesn't matter if I kill someone while burning these buildings. That's not relevant. And even if they're black people, I don't care. But my official stance on the matter is Black Lives Matter. And then you have this other guy who is saying Black Lives Matter. The life of a black fetus matters because, as you know, abortion is, it affects black people at a disproportionate rate compared to other races. If we ended abortion in America, the racial group that would be most benefited by the lack of termination of fetuses would be black people, because they are the ones who commit abortions at the highest rates proportionately. I think I could be wrong with this, but I think it was like last time I checked, it was something like 38% of abortions are by black people, even though they are 13% of the population in America. So I could be wrong on the exact numbers, on the details, but the principle is valid, and you can look it up if you want to, that black people abort fetuses at a almost maybe twice or three times the rate of the rest of the country, or the rest of the population. So this guy was saying, Black lives matter. The life of that black little fetus matters to me. And that was enough to destroy him. And then suddenly he was not black anymore. So there's this constant hypocrisy that you see with the Democrats who... are not consistent in their behavior. Everything is very irrational, very evil. And they're willing to lie, cheat, smear, and destroy. And this act that they were doing about destroying his reputation goes to that fundamental human right that the idiot founding fathers missed out on in the Constitution, the right to a fair reputation. Remember, there are five fundamental human rights: the right to life, the right to property, the right to privacy, the right to a fair reputation, and the right to a personal domain. You cannot have a solid legal system, a government system, without those five rights clearly stated and defined. So we should have criminal penalties for anyone who maliciously destroys the reputation unfairly of another person. I mean, if you're calling someone a murderer and he is a murderer, then that's not attacking his fair reputation. That's what he is. He's a murderer. And if there's proof, you know, that's it. You know, no rights have been violated. But if you smear someone and say he is a murderer when the guy doesn't even touch a fly or an insect, then you are violating his rights, and that should have criminal penalties associated to it, not just the financial penalties that we have in our system. People should go to jail and spend time in jail, years in jail, if they do a smearing of reputation. Just like they did with this black entrepreneur in Virginia. So, but Democrats don't care about human rights. They talk about them all the time, but they don't care about them. They're willing to trample on the human rights of those that disagree with them. And then suddenly they turn around, and when something happens to one of their people, then suddenly the opposition is the one that's out to destroy and trample on anyone who disagrees with them. They are inconsistent. That's why, even when the Democrat message sometimes has this allure, the allure of the siren, or you know that, or a mermaid, or whatever, you know that woman that sailors hear the voice, the mythical voice of the. Of this woman in the sea that calls to them. That's how the Democrat message is. It's an alluring message. And sometimes I even feel the allure of it. First, because it's saying surrender to the system, and then you can live it in peace and no longer be in constant struggle with the rest of the world. Everyone will agree with you. You will agree with the mainstream. You will agree with everyone. Everyone will like you. You'll like everyone. Kumbaya. But, you know, the message of social justice and all this, there's a certain allure to it. But when you get up close, you go, these people can't be speaking the truth, because they act like crazy people. They act like people who are not consistent in their behavior. That's when you start kind of waking up, and that entrancing voice suddenly kind of loses its power. And you go, hey, these people are crazy. These people don't know right from wrong, because they're not even trying to discern right from wrong. There's something fundamentally wrong with them. But the reason why I want to bring up this Nancy Pelosi and Paul Pelosi situation is not only to point out that hypocrisy that white liberals have when judging things, but also the fact that it's coming out slowly that this guy who did the attack is a white guy, and a guy from the San Francisco area, from the Berkeley, California area. And he has a history of being this kind of hippie type person. And there, a picture came out of him, doing a marriage between two people, a nudist marriage. So the two people getting married were naked. And he was officiating, that's the word, officiating the wedding. This was in 2013, you know, in the San Francisco area. And so that kind of gives you the idea of what kind of a guy he is. And apparently he sells hemp ornamented jewelry or necklaces or things like that, you know, things made out of cannabis, marijuana, hemp. So he's in that, you know, that crazy world. And apparently, I don't know if he has a permanent home. He's semi-homeless and a hippie, you know, the San Francisco hippie type drug, who delves into drugs and apparently has drug addiction issues and things like that. But the weird thing is that on the one side, he has, you know, he's the typical liberal. That's what liberals aim for, the life of leisure, where you are fed by the government while the elites control your life. So he's the perfect opium-taking citizen that the liberal idealizes. But on the other hand, he, and this is the side that the Democrats are using right now, is that he apparently has been online. I don't know how, you know, he makes enough money at least to go somewhere and post things online, I guess. And he has posted a lot of crazy things about conspiracy theories and things like that, about the government doing this, that, and the other. So on the one hand, he is the perfect liberal. And on the other hand, he seems like this radical right-wing conservative, which he is not. But he says things that the people who followed the QAnon thing and all that would agree with. And he's one of those people, and I hope I don't offend you by saying this, he's one of the idiots who thinks that 9/11 was a conspiracy. And that angers me profoundly for many reasons that would go outside the scope of this audio snippet. Because it just goes to the root of what's wrong with this country and why it's dying. But he apparently is one of those 9/11 conspiracy theorists. And it's important to mention this because it shows that when conservatives start becoming so defensive about their Constitution, the Founding Fathers, as we've said before, they become prey to this almost spirit, you could say, that comes and starts telling them, yeah, the Founding Fathers did it all correctly, and the justification for things being wrong is that there's this conspiracy going on to destroy the perfect system that the Founding Fathers left behind, because that's the only way to explain why it's all falling apart, instead of going to, oh, we built the house wrong. No, it's some evil force from the outside trying to tear the house down and infiltrating the house to destroy it. So you open yourself up to that sort of thinking, and that's when you start listening to QAnon and all these other things that that have seeds of truth in them. It's like they do say things that are true, but then they take them in a direction that's not there, and it just takes you down the wrong path. So you can see there that if this nutjob liberal was willing to listen to this stuff, it just says a lot about what's wrong with this stuff, this conspiracy stuff. I hope you're getting what I'm saying. There's something not right here if this guy finds this stuff so appealing to him. And let me just mention the 9/11 stuff very very briefly. That would be a multiple audio snippets worth of talk, but it's important to say this, I believe, even in this audio snippet, that, for example, people always say, you know, why did the Twin Towers collapse the way they did? It looked like this perfect implosion. Like, you know, when people want to demolish a building and they do this controlled detonation of explosives in different parts of the building to make it fall on itself. And people go, yeah, that's what happened with the Twin Towers. That proves it was a conspiracy, that Bush did it so that he could have an excuse to go attack Afghanistan and Iraq. And you go, my goodness, how can you even go there? But the reason why the buildings fell like that is that they were designed in a very specific, peculiar way. They were designed by this Japanese fellow in the early 1970s. And he did a very kind of innovative design for that time that allowed for the construction of a very lightweight building that was very sturdy, but lightweight at the same time. And it, if you want to read the details of how this building was created, I recommend that you do an internet search on and find an article on this website called TMS.org. And TMS, if you, and to remember that, just think of Thomas. You know, if you're doubting Thomas about all this stuff, what happened in 9/11, Thomas, just think of the word Thomas and take out the vowels and the letter H, and you get TMS. So TMS.org. And if you want to find the article, just do a search on TMS and the words World Trade Center Collapse. And near the top or at the top, you will see the article I'm referring to. It's a very technical article. When you read it, you go, these are not people who are Democrat, Republican, conservative, liberal. They're just like engineers. It's kind of like an engineering website or kind of a semi-scientific, semi-engineering website. So they're not a political action group or anything like that. And they give a very, very kind of down-to-earth, objective explanation of how the building was designed and why it collapsed. It's very interesting. It's very refreshing to read something that's so objective. And it says, yes, this is weird, but this is the explanation for this, and this, you know, very, very objective, looking at all sides and all that. But the thing is that they explain how the building was designed with columns. It's they call it like a perimeter column, perimeter tube design. So the columns were like near the outside of the building. Because usually you think of a building with all these columns internally, very solidly built, one floor at a time, going up and up and up. But this was more of an efficient design where these columns were kind of bearing the weight towards the outside, and everything else was very hollow. So the Twin Towers were very hollow, and that allowed for more office space. And these columns that were near the exterior were very cleverly designed to bear the weight of the building. And the design was also focused on wind resistance, because, you know, the higher you go with the skyscraper, the more you have to consider the winds blowing and hitting the building, and that can cause some sort of problem. If you don't account for that, you can have the building destroy itself. So the building is very wind resistant. So it was designed to control to be able to control forces attacking it from the sides, and that's why when the building was hit with this massive airplane, each of those two buildings, they didn't just topple over to the side. It's like they were able to absorb, because when you see the buildings getting hit, you see how it's like the building, the plane just goes into the building and gets absorbed into the building. And obviously there's an explosion and all that. But the building did not suffer a collapse right then and there. It didn't topple over. It didn't like lean over. You just see it. You see the building almost absorbing the punch, you know, like someone standing and getting punched in the gut and just taking the punch in. So the two buildings were able to withstand that side impact because they were designed to withstand strong wind from the sides. But the thing is that because they had this hollow structure within, once they started, and the thing also is that the columns that were hit on the side that was hit were destroyed, but they had a lot of redundancy. The design was very, very brilliant. And the other columns were able to withstand the burden that was no longer being borne by the columns that were hit in the impact. But then the fire started and the heat, and slowly, it was not that the steel melted, it just became weaker and weaker. And then eventually it led to this kind of like the columns that were bearing the burden, that were still bearing the burden, after a while just were not able to bear it anymore. And they started falling. It was like a pancake effect. But the building fell on itself because it was so well built to withstand side impacts, so cleverly designed. And that's why when the floor that got hit began to collapse, it collapsed almost vertically. So it's almost a miracle that the design was so well made that it prevented the building kind of like collapsing to the side, because if it had collapsed to the sides, it would have been a massive, massive disaster. But it's like, it's as if in an almost spiritual sense, figurative sense, it's as if these buildings were saying, were there and say, hit me, and I'm going to take the hit, and I'm not going to let anyone else suffer. I will pay the price. I will go down. I will die for you. And that's kind of what happened to the building. It was a very innovative, very different design. You have to understand the Twin Towers were designed in the early, late 60s, early 70s. And this Japanese guy was thinking of some sort of innovative way of designing the building in a way that was not only going to be sturdy, but cheap to build, and with a lot of office space. That's why, you know, they were able to build it, because I think that the Twin Towers were the tallest buildings on Earth when they were built. Building a building that tall was not a normal thing in those days. So that's why he came up with this brilliant design that was cost effective and very strong. That's why they collapsed like that. And then there's the World Trade Center 7, because when you think of the World Trade Center, you think of the Twin Towers, but they were part of a complex of buildings, and they each had a number. There's the two Twin Towers were World Trade Center 1 and World Trade Center 2. And then there was World Trade Center 3, 4, 5, and so forth. And then there was this World Trade Center 7 building that also collapsed along with 1 and 2, with the Twin Towers. And that's also, it also brings up a lot of conspiracies, because the building was not hit and it collapsed. So they go, oh, that must have been Bush who also set up some explosives in that building, and he made sure that collapsed too to have more of a justification. And you go, okay, so you're saying Osama bin Laden colluded with Bush in order to give Bush an excuse to invade an Arab country. Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, of course. Of course. Now it makes sense. Yes, Osama bin Laden, the hardened Muslim, is conspiring with an infidel white imperialist so that his Muslim countries get conquered and invaded by the white infidel. Of course. Yes. I mean, obvious. It's clear as day now. The thing is that the reason that the fact that World Trade Center 7 collapsed has always been a justification for saying, hey, you know, there was a conspiracy, because how did this building collapse? Clearly, they had explosives there, and maybe it didn't go as planned originally, but they decided, let's have the building collapse anyway, even though it was not hit. But the thing is that there is an explanation for that building collapsing. What happened was that the North Tower, World Trade Center 1, collapsed. And when it collapsed, the debris from that building started hitting the wall of the nearby 7 building. And the damage to the exterior wall was not what brought it down. What happened was that started fires, and obviously the water system was not flowing properly in that area because of the collapse, what had happened. So the sprinklers were not turned on to properly put out the fires that were caused when the exterior walls were hit. And you have to remember, the FDNY, the New York Fire Department, was busy trying to deal with the towers and the collapse and rescuing people. You know the story. So they were busy with these two buildings, and then the fire started, and then they were dealing with everything that was going on, and the fire started when the North Tower collapsed. And they didn't, it's not like a normal fire where you have a fire in a building and then the fire department shows up and puts out the fire. The fire department was not, it had no time to deal with that fire. So the fire burned for hours and hours and hours. And that's one thing that conspiracists don't think about. The fire burned for hours and hours. And because of that, it eventually started doing damage to the steel. And the same thing that had happened to the world, to the Twin Towers, began to happen to this World Trade Center 7 building. So the it started going to the side a little bit, and then the building, the floors that got hit, it's almost like they got hit not by a plane but by the debris from the North Tower. That those floors started collapsing, and then the pancake effect happened, and that's how the building started collapsing on itself. And so we had three buildings fall down that day. Number one, number two, and number seven. That gives you the number 127. And I don't know if we've mentioned this on the website where these things are posted, but the number 127 is very significant. It to me, it's like, wow, it's almost like a perfect poetic element to the whole thing. Sad as it was, there was a certain perfect poetry to it. The number 127 appearing there. I hope it's mentioned somewhere on the website. I don't want to mention it here. But it's perfectly fitting with what happened that day. Those buildings, it's as if they were like two witnesses willing to die and sacrifice. Standing up for something in order to bring the restoration of other people. And because of those two buildings collapsing, two evil kingdoms collapsed too. The Taliban in Afghanistan and Saddam Hussein in Iraq, one for each building. Obviously, the senile bastard, son of a bitch, was going to burn in hell soon. Has smeared what was done in Afghanistan. So now the Taliban are back in power and stronger than ever, stronger than before 9/11, actually. They control more territory and are more powerful. Now they have billions of dollars of all the weapons we left behind because the son of a bitch, bastard, senile, left them there on purpose. But even so, Afghanistan had 20 years of freedom from the oppression of the Taliban, because of the sacrifice of this tower and the people who were in it. So this guy who attacked Paul Pelosi is a 9/11 denier, conspiracy theorist. And he's into all that dark stuff. And that's all going to get used to attack conservatives. And that's why you conservatives, why are you open this door? You open this door to all this evil, all these nonsense conspiracy theories that keep you entertained and keep you distracted from dealing with all the problems the founding fathers left and fixing the Constitution and fixing the whole system. So you're all entertained and mentally enthralled by all this conspiracy nonsense. And this is the door through which now you're going to be attacked for a lot of, for what this guy did. This guy is not a conservative, but he likes the conspiracy side of the conservative movement, and he's a hippie, drug-induced fellow. And the fact that such a guy likes your conspiracy theorists conservative should make you think. As I said, many of the things in the conspiracy theories are true, but they're taken and then in a direction that's not valid. And then that's when it starts getting all messed up. But so I did want to point this out, this how this guy is a reflection of what's bad with America. He's a nut job, white, drug-taking liberal. And at the same time, he believes a lot of the nonsense. The people that he married, I don't know how he married them. Maybe it was just a ceremonial thing, or I don't know if he's an ordained minister, because some people are ordained to marry people. The people that he married are also conspiracy theorists to crazy nut jobs in San Francisco who believe in all that stuff too. But they're also leftists. The thing is that that's how this guy apparently showed up in Paul Pelosi's home to beat the hell out of him. I don't feel sorry for him. I have been waiting for Nancy to get what's coming to her. It's not that I am, but you know, you desire things, and when you desire things, they go into the atmosphere, and then things happen, even though you're not involved literally in it. So it's our version of Dimmock, just like the liberals are doing, and we talked about that in the previous audio snippet. It's our version of Dimmock, just like the, you know, a person takes a shot, the mRNA gene therapy injection, and dies months later or weeks later, and there seems to be no connection between one and the other. The same thing here. And the fact that this guy's called Paul Pelosi is just the contrast with how they treated the attack on Rand Paul, a sitting senator. I mean, it's outrageous. I think most people, if I ask people on the street, do you know what happened to Rand Paul? I think the vast majority would say, Rand who? And if this had happened, let's say 40, 50 years ago to a sitting senator, it would have been headline news. Everybody would have been outraged and like, what? How did this happen? And this is so horrible. And yes, we don't agree with him, but how could this have ever been done to a sitting senator? There's none of that anymore, you know? And just because he was a Republican, if it had been a Democrat, that would have been more reason to put more Trump supporters in jail and all that, and that's what they're going to try to do with this situation. And I did need to mention this, and this ties in with the things that we wanted to talk about in this audio snippet. So we'll just go ahead and start talking a little bit about those things. First, which is wanted to end what we wanted to say about the 15th Amendment. We read the two sections before, and section two said, as you may recall, the Congress shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. And that was in reference to section one, which gives the right of citizens to vote to anyone and cannot be abridged by reason of color or race or previous slavery, condition of slavery. And this, again, brings out the thing we shared it about the 14th Amendment, which has an identical clause at the end. Why in the world do we need a section like this, saying the Congress shall have power to enforce this article? Well, isn't that just obvious by default? I mean, if it's in the Constitution, then the Congress has the authority to pass legislation in accordance with what's in the Constitution. So why do you need a section like this? And this, as we said before, highlights how ambiguous and confusing the Constitution is in terms of what it allows and doesn't allow. And that's why these radical Republicans who passed all of this felt the need to add a section like that was so obvious, but they said just to be sure, because we're the Constitution is so vague about so many things that we don't want to get hit with some sort of legal argument that invalidates any effort on our part to protect the right to vote of people, that the right to vote that we are enabling in this amendment. So that again points to this, there's something wrong with the Constitution. The framework is not clearly metaphysically or philosophically well-defined. I mean, even if you don't agree or don't agree with it, it's just not well-written, not well-built. See, it has to be built like a mathematical system. In mathematics, you start with axioms or postulates, things that you believe in that you don't need to prove, because there are certain things you just have to start with. You have to start with something. So you start with these postulates. It's like truths that you accept without proof. They're very simple, very basic. And once you accept them, because you just see them as true, you can't prove it, just know it's true or assume it's true. Then you start with those and you combine these postulates to build these axioms. These are small truths that are proved through the postulates. And those axioms and lemmas, they're also called lemmas, are combined to build a more complex truth called a theorem. So this theorem is proved through lemmas and axioms that are in turn proved through postulates. And with theorems, then once you prove a theorem, then you can prove another more complex theorem on top of it, and then you build this structure, this system of truths that are built on a postulate and a foundation. It's all very clear. If you want to prove something is true, you can eventually, it's like a tree that grows from the foundation, and any truth out there can eventually be traced down the tree to one or more of the foundational postulates. That's how the system should be. And that's why we began talking in these audio snippets about the 10 pillars of the new American Constitution. 5 pillars that define authority and 5 pillars that define the 5 fundamental human rights. And the system should be very clear. And it should have very clear rules of action of how Congress can enforce these things. That Congress has the authority to enact any law that's consistent, like a theorem. It's like every bill is a theorem, and the theorem has to be built on top of the foundation. So that's why we said that every bill should have an explanation of saying this is in support of this pillar and this pillar. And in other words, it has to say there's something in the Constitution that validates me as a bill. Just like in mathematics, a theorem, you cannot just say this is true. You have to prove it's true, and you have to prove it through the postulates and axioms and theorems that have already been proved before. So you eventually have to validate the validity of your theorem based on previous truths that have been established. And it's the same with the bills. The bills should at least point to the pillars. This is in accordance with Pillar 1 and Pillar 5 and so forth, or Pillar 9 or Pillar 8. And therefore, obviously, there'd be no need for a Section 2 like the one that the 15th Amendment has. It would all be obvious. And we'd have a system where we know the Congress can do this, but not that. You know, like the thing that we've had with the agencies, government agencies who have run amok. Because the Constitution has no clarity on who can do what. Because the government agencies that have run amok are part of the executive branch. But they're doing a lot of legislative work. And you could say, well, the legislature has granted that legislative work to the executive branch, but the Constitution should have been very clear that can't happen. But we've talked about that a little bit in the past, and we'll talk about that a little more later in these audio snippets, as we get to the other parts that we want to mention regarding Grant. But going back to the 15th Amendment, this amendment was ratified on the 3rd of February of 1870. And by that time, Grant was already in the White House. And that's when it became part of the Constitution. And the voting to approve it in the House and the Senate Let me just give you a quick recount of how many voted for it. We may have mentioned this before, but 144 Republicans voted for it, 0 Democrats, 39 didn't vote, and 7 abstained. 7 were too cowardly to vote either way. And in the Senate, 33 Republicans voted for the 15th Amendment, and 0 voted against it. But even with no Democrat support in the House or the Senate, it was able to pass because the House and the Senate were overwhelmingly Republican at the time. It was this brief period when we had the chance to set things right, and that's how it got passed. And the problem with this 15th Amendment was that even though it was well-intentioned, as the 19th century progressed after Grant, and because after what happened in 1874, which we'll get to someday, it all went downhill from there. And then as the 19th century ended, the Supreme Court began to make decisions that interpreted this 15th Amendment in a very narrow way. It's as if they pretended like they were abiding by the 15th Amendment, but they were nitpicking the words and making them so literal that the 15th Amendment kind of became ineffective, to the point that in the years between 1890 and 1910, by 1890, things just had gotten very bad. And by that time it was over. I mean, it started dying in 1874, and by when you got to 1890, it was over. And between 1890 and 1910, the Democrats in the South began to adopt new state constitutions, and they enacted what are known as Jim Crow laws that began to raise barriers to voter registration. So they said, okay, the 15th Amendment says we can't deny black people the right to vote, but we're going to find a way around it. We're going to find a technicality. And they began to pass these laws because it didn't say that that if you had the intention of denying a black man the vote, that was wrong. It was saying if you explicitly deny it, then that's wrong. So they said, okay, let's implicitly deny them the right to vote. So they did these workarounds, and these barriers prevented most blacks and even some many poor whites from voting. They were disenfranchised. They started putting these restrictions, like poll taxes, and discriminatory literacy tests. Because they knew that black people were more illiterate than white people, so they said, okay, let's put these literacy tests. They started putting all these barriers because they didn't want the black man to vote, because the Democrats wanted to regain control in the South, and they knew that black people would vote Republican. Kind of ironic, because in those days, black people automatically vote Republican, justifiably so. Now black people automatically vote Democrat, unjustifiably so. And the Democrats wanted to regain power in the state legislatures because they had already been admitted into the Union. See, that all of this should have never happened, because the South should have never been allowed back into the Union in the state it was. It had to be continually humiliated and controlled like a little colony, like our little bitch and property in the South. That's how we should have treated the South until the South repented. And then we would have said, okay, now you're back in the house. But we're going to treat you as our little bitch or little slave, and you're going to obey us and do whatever the hell we tell you to do, just like you would to your slaves back in the day. And we're going to treat you like a bitch and a slave until you repent, and then we will let you back in the Union. But because we allowed them back as regular states, then they knew that all they needed to do was regain control of the state legislatures, and then they could do whatever the hell they wanted to do again. And part of that plan involved disenfranchising black people. So they started doing these poll taxes and all these other things. And the weird thing is that they put it, all these barriers, and what they would do is that they would put grandfather clauses to prevent these restrictions applying to white people. So it's like they would put in this new restriction. You can't vote unless you meet this requirement. But they would put this grandfather clause saying, but if you were if your family or whatever was already a citizen, or if you were already a citizen before black people were allowed to vote, then this does not apply to you. You can continue voting. In other words, if you had been able to vote before, you can continue voting. It's just if you're a new voter, this restriction applies to you. I hope I'm making sense with what I'm trying to say. But they would never say white or black. They would just say, okay, if you've been able to vote before, this does not apply to you. But if you're a new voter, you must meet this requirement. And obviously, white people had been voting from before, so they were not affected. But they knew that black people had not voted before, so now this restriction applied to them. So it's a very vicious system. So, and then these cases would go to the Supreme Court saying, hey, this is a violation of the 15th Amendment. And the Supreme Court would narrowly look at the law and say, it doesn't say white or black here. It doesn't say that. So therefore, it is not a violation of the 15th Amendment. That's kind of where we ended up being. And this all goes to the problem that, again, we allowed the state legislatures to decide who could vote, who could not. Why were we doing that? Do you know whose fault that is? As we've said a million times before, it's the idiot founding fathers. Why? If you don't believe me, go look it up in the Constitution. In the Constitution, there's a clause that the founding fathers put very explicitly, very blatantly, very clearly saying it is the state who decide all the regulations related to voting. They decide who can vote and all the restrictions and how the voting is going to be implemented. Everything is decided by the states. The federal government has no authority on that. So then every state could decide whether, you know, on their own, whether who could vote and who could not. It was the founding fathers who left this because of federalism in the system, because they believed in the stupid federalist system. And that's why these people were able to get away with this. Again, federalism working for you. And the thing is that just to give you a sense of things with regard to voting, and I was a little bit stunned when I found this out, but black people were, you would think that black people were being oppressed and not allowed to vote, not be part of the political system in the South because they were slaves there and all that. And that kind of automatically makes you think that in the North there was relative freedom for black people. They were not enslaved, and they were more a part of the political process than in the South and so forth. And that kind of, and you start kind of filling the gaps in a sense in your mind, to the point that you start thinking, at least I'm describing what happened to me, that you start thinking that black people could actually vote in the North. But the fact is that they couldn't. The sad thing is that they could not vote in the North. I found out about this as I was, you know, looking into all these things that we're sharing here. Just so you know, for example, there was and this is related to something we wanted to talk about with Grant, and it's the Naturalization Act of 1870 that he signed into law. Remember, Grant was president from 1868 to 1876. I always say 68, even though he took office in 69, but it's confusing to me. I always think of presidential terms in terms of years that are multiple of four. So he was elected in 1868, took over in 69. And was in the White House until 1876, and then he transferred power in 1877 to the next guy, and so forth. But you could say Grant was in office from 1868 to 1876, in a sense. So in that period, 1870, July 14th, Bastille Day of 1870, he signed the Naturalization Act of 1870 that allowed blacks to become citizens. And this was like a revised form of the Naturalization Act of 1790. 1790, that's what, 14 years after the independence of the U.S., and 2 years into the first presidential term. We became a regular country in 1789, right after the ratification of the Constitution in 1787, 1788, and then 1789, the first year of Washington, first year of his two terms. And so into his second year, we passed the Naturalization Act of 1790, which granted naturalized citizenship to, quote, free white persons of good character. And this was a way to remove the property requirement that for citizenship and voting without enfranchising black people. So in other words, this Naturalization Act of 1790 says, if you're not a citizen, you can become a citizen if you're a free man, if you're a white man, and you have good character. And we'll talk about that good character part later on, because that's an important part of our immigration system that we haven't really taken into account. We need to change the whole immigration system too. That's for another audio snippet. But the thing is that in 1790, we allowed free white people a way to become citizens of the United States if they were not already. But even if they became citizens, the states were still allowed to grant voting rights. So you could become a citizen and still not be able to vote, ironically. But that was not a problem for white people, for the most part, in all the states. But then we have the Naturalization Act of 1870, 80 years later. So we have the 1790 Naturalization Act that says white people can become citizens of the U.S. if they're not already. And then you have the Naturalization Act of 1870 that allowed black people to also become citizens. So in other words, for example, if you're Haitian or from Senegal in Africa or from Ethiopia or whatever, and you migrated to the U.S., before 1870, there was no chance in hell you could become a citizen. But after this act, you could. And this also was intended to make this the not just the black people from outside, but the black people in America, just give them the opportunity. You are entitled to become a citizen. If you're not already, you can become a citizen. So that so before the Act of 1790, when the country was founded, the right to vote was restricted to gentlemen of property and standing. So most people did not own enough property to vote. So that's why they passed the Act of 1790 to kind of remove the restriction of property. And say, as long as you're white, you can vote. Before the Civil War, blacks did have suffrage or the right to vote in New York, in New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. So even though states were not required to allow black people to become citizens, because the 1790 Naturalization Act said white people cannot be restricted from being citizens, but some states said, okay, we'll let black people be citizens, and there were three in the North before the Civil War: New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, that allowed black people to be citizens and to vote. But sadly enough, New Jersey rescinded the suffrage of black people. New Jersey, the state from which this recording is being done, it was rescinded in 1807. And that is so sad. That was, I think, the almost towards the end of the second Jefferson term. The state of New Jersey, way up in the north, no need for oppressing black people, but or enslaving them and putting them in a plantation. They rescinded the right of black people to vote. New Jersey, shame on you. And then Pennsylvania rescinded the right to black people in 1838. Some 30 years later, Pennsylvania chose to do that. New York all but effectively rescinded it in 1821 because there was a state constitution that was passed in 1821 that imposed a heavy property ownership requirement, but it was only on black voters. It was so evil. So in 1821, which is interestingly the year of independence for a lot of countries in Latin America, I believe a lot of countries became independent from Spain in 1821. It was a very significant year in the world stage. In that year, New York passed this a new state constitution that put a heavy requirement of property ownership, but just for black people. So what if you were white and you were poor, you could still be a citizen and vote. But if you were black, you had to be a wealthy black guy to be able to vote. New York did that in 1821. And when I found out about this, my heart was just sickened and saddened. That it's as if, yes, black people were not enslaved in the North, but even so, they were not. There was no effort to see them as people. They couldn't vote. Effectively, they couldn't vote. New Jersey, why did you rescind the right of black people to vote in 1807? Why? Why did you do that? Pennsylvania, why did you do that? I mean, you took a little longer than the others. Oh, wow, congratulations. Why did you do it in 1838? What happened? Why? What was the problem? Were you afraid? What was going on? And New York, why did you do that too in 1821? So evil. You were kind of like the tricky one. You said, we're not going to be racist and officially ban all black people from voting. We'll just ban all the non-rich black people from voting. And because there were so few rich black people to begin with, that effectively prevented the vast majority of black people voting. Why did you do that? It's so evil. So no wonder there was no... It's as if the North was also complicit in the oppression of black people. And that's why when Frederick Douglass, he was, you know, a slave in Maryland, he lived in Baltimore. And I always mention Baltimore because that's where I grew up. He lived in Baltimore. He was able to escape from his slave master, and he was self-educated, self-taught, and he eventually made it to the UK and began to speak in the UK about the situation of slavery in America. And he said that when he went to the UK, he felt like a free man, that in a place where people treated him like a normal human being, and that he never felt the same that in his own country, in America. And you think about that. The people of the UK, the British, who were the supposed oppressors that we fought against in 1776 because they were for tyranny and we were for freedom. The tyrants were treating black people better than the promoters of liberty, the land of liberty. You see the irony there. So even in the North, black people didn't feel validated as human beings. That is so, so sad. And it took us until 1870, 5 years after the end of the Civil War, to pass this Naturalization Act and saying, hey, you know, blackness is not a restriction against becoming a citizen if you're not one already. And it took us 5 years because of Stonewall Johnson, who was there. Why was Stonewall Johnson there? Because the son of a bitch Lincoln put him there as his vice president. that he got shot, deservedly so, and then this son of a bitch took over. And I can assure you, if Lincoln had become president, state president for his second term, stayed alive, things would not have been much different. I can tell you, it would not have been much different. I can assure you. And you know what would have happened if Lincoln had stuck around? He was drawing bad vibes. I know that I'm sounding crazy by saying this, but let me just say this intuitively. He would have drawn all these bad vibes towards him, that he would have caused the people of the South to rebel a second time. And we would have had a Civil War Part II if he had stayed around. So in a certain sense, a certain sad sense, it was, you know, given the circumstances, it was better for him to die and have Stonewall Johnson than to have him stay alive. I mean, the ideal situation would have been for him to be a man of character, a man of integrity, and to do what had to be done. Then we would have been okay. But because he wasn't, then the best option was for him to be killed and gotten rid of so that we could continue, even if it was with Stonewall Johnson. But with Stonewall Johnson, things got delayed. We had to wait until 1870 for this act to come. And black people were finally given the right to vote. And I know that we haven't gotten to the part that seems to connect to what we said at the beginning. But let me just say this very quickly. I hope we can sneak this in, because I want you to see that what we said at the very beginning that seems so unrelated is connected to all of this. Grant was able to win the election in 1868, resoundingly. He became popular because of his opposition to Andrew Johnson's, you know, foot-dragging, his stonewalling. That's why we call him Stonewall Johnson. So people began to see, hey, you know, there was this man, this war hero, who was beginning to speak up boldly. And Grant was a very intelligent person. You know, people think of him as this, you know, general, and he had a bit of a drinking problem too. So some people think of him as a drunkard, and, you know, like a drunken sailor kind of thing, you know, drunken soldier. But he was a very bright man. I remember hearing about him writing a book. I think it was about this, maybe a kind of a narration of what happened during the Civil War. I don't remember exactly what the book was about, but people who have read the book have found it very surprisingly well written. He didn't have a ghostwriter or anything like that. The guy was a very smart fellow, very eloquent, very well versed, an intelligent man. To me, he is one of the 20 greatest Americans of all time, probably in the top three or top four greatest presidents in American history. He's very much underrated, I believe. The thing is that he became popular because he was an eloquent, outspoken opponent of what Andrew Johnson was doing. So he won, and also part of why he was overwhelmingly elected is that the Confederates were still prevented from voting in the South. So he won a lot of Southern states because of that. So that also enabled him to win resoundingly. And he worked to get the 15th Amendment ratified, because the 15th Amendment that we've just spoken about was approved by Congress and sent to the states during Johnson's time. So Congress had already passed it. The thing is, they didn't need Andrew Johnson to sign it, because the ratification system we have for amendments in America, for the Constitution, to add an amendment to the Constitution, doesn't require the president approving the bill. So thankfully, the president is kind of like out of the way in that sense. It's just the legislatures that have to approve it. The Congress has to approve it and then pass, and then have the state legislatures vote on it. And if 3/4 vote for it, then it becomes an official amendment. So that had all happened during Johnson's time. But he was speaking out against it, and the South and all the legislatures were dragging their feet along with him. But when Grant took over in the White House, he kind of promoted the 15th Amendment, even though he didn't have an authority to pass it or deny it or anything. but he promoted it and he helped it to get approved. And when, you know what Grant said about the 15th Amendment's ratification when it finally got ratified? He said, quote, "It's a measure of grander importance than any other act of the kind from the foundation of our free government to the present day," unquote. That's what Grant said about the 15th Amendment. This man really cared about Black America. And this guy knew that there was something wrong with our system starting from 1776 and 1788. As I've said a million times before, slavery had to happen. Black people had to be enslaved, chained, and brought here and subjected to what they were subjected to, because it's a punishment that they brought on themselves through their actions historically in Africa. And it's as if they were being given a chance to start anew, but they had to pay the price, had to pay the price and the punishment first. And in 1734, I think it was, so 1732, when the state of Georgia, the colony of Georgia, was established, that's when, well, that was the beginning of the end of the punishment of Black people. It's like, okay, now you have made your payment. Now we're going to get you into the process of making you a free man, a free woman. And we, as a nation, were supposed to, between 1732 or 34, that year of the founding of Georgia, and 1776, through those 44 years, more or less, we were going to be required to start a slow process of ending slavery across the whole country. And then between 1776 and 1788, we had to finally kind of lay out the legal mumbo jumbo or terms that needed to be put into our system to ensure that Black people were legally regular, full-fledged American citizens. And so we had 12 years between 1776 and 1788 to get that done. So by the founding, we had to have this fixed. And this is what Grant was saying. That's why he said this is a measure of grander importance than any other act of the kind from the foundation of our free government to the present day. Now, he was basically saying, without saying it, that there was a problem with our foundation, and we needed to get this fixed. And now that we've done it, this is kind of the beginning of the restoration of us as a people, as a country. He understood that. I don't think conservatives understand that, even to this day. And I don't think we're going to be able to get to what we need to say to connect it to. Let me just say quickly here. In 1869, on 24th of December of 1869, Grant established a federal military rule in Georgia and restored Black legislators who had been expelled from the state legislature. So he sent the army to Georgia, and he said, "You're going to be run by the like a colony." He was doing what we've been saying here. He went to Georgia. Georgia had expelled Black legislators who had been elected. So the Confederates were starting to stir things up in Georgia, the root, the place where slavery had to begin to end. Interestingly, I just mentioned Georgia a moment ago, unknowingly, and now we're talking about Georgia here. So Georgia established federal military. He established federal military rule in Georgia at the end of 1869, because they were not letting Black people, be free. They had expelled all Black legislators from the state legislature. So, like, we're going to run this thing. This is going to be a white state again. And Grant sent the military. We had to treat the South like a conquered territory, and Grant did that. By mid-1870, the former Confederate states of Virginia, Texas, Mississippi, and Georgia had finally ratified the 15th Amendment. Because if Grant had not done what he did in Georgia, there's no chance that Georgia would have ever ratified the 15th Amendment, because they had expelled all Black legislators. And without Black legislators, with the state legislature run by white racists, there was no chance in hell that the 15th Amendment could be ratified in Georgia. But because he did this in Georgia, and apparently all the other states took notice of what he did. They kind of got scared, and they let things be, and they allowed black legislators who had been elected in the, their legislatures to stay put, and eventually the by mid-1870, these former Confederate states all ratified the 15th Amendment, and then they were readmitted into the Union after they had approved the 15th Amendment. And I just kind of disagree, sadly, that they had did this. They should have not let them in just like that. But unfortunately, they were. So that was a mistake. And in mid-1870 is very important because by on June 22nd of 1870, Grant signed the bill that created the Justice Department. And this is where the connection is done is to what we were saying at the beginning. Because he created the Justice Department, and we're going to talk about that in the next audio snippet, all the great things he did through the Justice Department. But because we didn't follow through, the Justice Department morphed into the opposite of what Grant created it for. And it opened this hole for all the things that the conspiracy theorists look at to justify their conspiracy theorists theories, because it's the same spirit, you could say, that moves in the Department of Justice, quote, currently, as the spirit, shall we say, that moves in the people who believe, the conservatives who believe on all these crazy conspiracy theories, including this guy who attacked Paul Pelosi, who was not a conservative, who was a nut job hippie liberal. But it's all connected, and hopefully you will see that more clearly, or we'll see that more clearly in the next audio snippet. Thank you very much for listening.